Session number 14129.
Mr. White, real toe.
We handed in the slip of paper, and the major looked up and said, "How's your Morse?" I said, "Not very good." He said, "Right, carry on, pass on down there." We passed on through the tent then. And he asked everybody this. And of course, Harry was okay, and Eric was okay. I'd never done any signalling, so that didn't matter anyhow. We went through the tents to a kitchen. We passed through the kitchen. We could smell, ooh, lovely food. The other end of it, we were taken into a billet, big hut. And in it were blankets, beds made with sheets, which was most unusual. You never had sheets in those days. Only aircrew got sheets. Anyhow, we thought, oh, this is nice. And in the middle was a roaring fire, lovely and warm. We thought, this is not bad. So we got in, put our stuff on the beds, and the RSM came in. And we all sort of leapt up, RSM, we got Mick Briody from the Irish Guards, the father of the regiment he became. He was a wonderful man. And now, I sit down, all of you. So all of you sit down now. He had a lovely Irish brogue. Now, how far have you come? So we all said the various places, and he said to us four, he said, "Now, where have you lot come from?" So he said, "Yorkshire. Oh, you've been a long time." "Oh, yes, we started out yesterday." "How will you entitle some money for that?" "Oh, are we? I'll get you the forms. And I'll fill them in for you, and all you do is sign them." And we got 3 and 6 pence, which was in those days a fortune. And he was a lovely man. Though he was the RSM, he was very strict, but very straight. And he was one of the nicest men I ever met in my army career. Wonderful man. We thought, well, this isn't so bad. And the next morning, then he said, "When you've signed those forms, I'll take you can have your food." And then the bacon, eggs, beautiful food, all we wanted. Served properly, not like we used to get it, in your mess tin and all that nonsense. And we thought, well, this is not a bad idea. And the next morning, we didn't. He said, "Now, there's no need for you to get up until 9 o'clock. We thought, oh, this is a dream. Mind you, it only happened that day. After that, it was 7 o'clock, which wasn't too bad. The next day, we were briefed in the briefing room, told what was going to happen, the various subjects we'd be learning whilst we were there, the drill with the Cowley, who was a wonderful bloke, really, who would teach us the foot drill, which, of course, we all knew anyhow. But and the two that could do Morse were whipped off the next week to Derby to do their flying training right away. Whereas we were stuck there for a few weeks, about 4 weeks, 3 or 4 weeks, to do the various subjects like airmanship, signalling Morse, the lamp and the key, navigational, a bit of navigation, maths, and aircraft recognition. Oh, and airmanship, that's right. A brief, every day at school lessons, we would sort of go through these subjects with a corporal there who was very good. And we were all then made up, if we weren't a full corporal, you were made up to full corporal. We spent, I say, 3 or 4 weeks. We used to do some drill with Cowley, who was the most amusing man. It was the only time I really enjoyed drill in the army, because we used to like to do it. It kept us fit. We used to do a bit of PT as well. It kept us fit. And he was the most amusing man for a guardsman. Whilst he would make you march and so on, he was also cracking jokes. And each one of you had to drill the squad. Had to take it in turns how to drill the squad round the square. And we had one chap, if you didn't shout loud enough, he would say, "Right, you take it this time," you see. And he used to say, if anybody had a quiet voice, come marching up to the, if we'd say, marching to the end of the square, he'd say, "He's going to shout an order. Pretend you don't hear him. Even if you can, you don't account hear him." Then he'd go back. We'd keep on marching right to the end of the, say, column of route straight on. Then he'd suddenly shout, and this fellow would be shouting, you see, and he said, keep marching. Then he'd say, I'd say something if it's only goodbye. Oh, squat, and he'd bellow, you see, and we'd turn around. And all little cracks like this, which really we used to enjoy. And he was a great personality. Great personality. Well, as indeed was the RSM. We did also some, oh yes, I can remember that too. Unarmed combat, which was very interesting. In case we had, and we had, did, apart from rifle drill, we did a bit of small arms of all kinds. LMGs, I think we had a Vickers. Yes, LMGs, Vickers. And a Tommy gun and a Sten gun. We did all the automatics as well as the ordinary rifle.
This is all at Tilshead?
This is all at Tilshead, yes. Which was quite good. And we were, in the meantime, we were also doing these lessons as well. Quite an intensive course. And then we were sent up to Derby. 16 EFTS Derby, as for flying. Well, I get onto my logbook now. When we arrived at Tilshead, at Derby, it was quite interesting. I think I'd seen an aerodrome before the war, but nothing like this, or in such a close proximity. We sort of got off the train and were met by a truck driven by Fannies in those days. And we thought, well, that's unusual. We've never been driven by a girl before, but we were. And we arrived at the Burmeston, and we were told that we would be briefed right away by the liaison officer, who wore purple trousers. He was one of the cherry pickers. Nice chap, Major. Well, we marched in there, and we sat down, and then he came in, and he said, now, the first thing I must tell you, chaps, is this. For God's sake, don't come in with your army boots here again. You've got to wear low shoes. They don't like it here, that. They don't like all this marching about. This was the flying training school, you see. And he said, secondly, open your battle dress and wear a tie. You're permitted to here. And the third thing is that you're going now from here, you're going to go back to live in Repton School. And some of you will be in the chapter house where you'll find very nice billets. Now, Warrant Officer Binks is the station warrant officer, and he'll take you over from there. You'll start flying tomorrow morning. You'll all have what we call an air trip to see if you like flying. And that was on the next morning. This was then April. March, April, that's right. So we'd been there a month at Tilshead. And we sort of, more or less after that, he said, right, now remember that, chaps. Don't bang those ammunition boots around here. We don't like it. But don't forget your drill, of course. So we all sort of crept out after that, taking our boots and gaiters off. We'd been told about the shoe lark, so we'd all got our shoes with us. And we got in these trucks. We were then taken to the school, Repton School. Binks was there, little chappy, pre-war station warrant officer, pre-war RAF chappy. Very nice little man. And he sort of, there was no sort of get on parade. He stood and said, all right, you chaps, you're over in that billet over there. And I've come and see you all. I want to know who can play cricket. That's all he could think of was cricket. And we went into these billets, which were beautiful. Nicely done, all sheets and pillowcases are lovely. In our view, like a hotel. And from then on, it was one day would be flying in the morning and ground subjects in the afternoon. The next day would be the other way round. And we then went back to the airfield with then our ties on, our shoes on, and we no gaiters or anything like that. And with a little white flash behind our badge, because at that time we still had whatever we were wearing when we left our old regiments. And you had a little white flash behind the badge. And the great fear then, having received all this treatment, and it was instilled into us also at Till said that if we ever did anything wrong in the eyes, we would be returned to our units. And nobody ever wanted that. So the RTU was the great mover, the great
motivator.
And very few were, in fact, RTU'd. But everyone was a volunteer. That was the big advantage. Every man in the Guard Department was a volunteer. Which made a difference, I think. Probably why it is still so strong today, what is left. We did my first flight with P.O. Humphreys. I enjoyed it, too. This was in a Magister. I enjoyed that very much. We were taught then how to swing a prop, how to start the engine. They were still back in the 1914 days too, I think. However, they were lovely kites. I liked them. They were good fun. And we stayed there, then we did the full course of 120... Look. We did night flying, yes. That was always interesting.
This is the number of hours flying you did,
isn't it? On the Magis, on the powered aircraft. This was on the powered aircraft before we went near gliders. And then we were all assessed after each course. 110 hours. We were all assessed after that, you see. And then after that course, if you passed that, which we all did, because you had to pass, by the way, 80% on all ground subjects as well. 80%. And that was included aircraft engines. That was easy. Airmanship, navigation, aircraft recognition, and signals. You had to have 80% on every subject, which was, I suppose, obviously quite good. They wanted a high standard. And then the other thing they had was link trainer. Now, the link trainer is like the simulator it is today, I think. And that was very amusing. It was in a little hut, this tiny little cockpit, basically, with tiny little wings on it, full of instruments. And you got in this cockpit, they closed the lid, and you had to fly it, purely on instruments. There was a little Welsh sergeant, RAF sergeant, who used to run a thing, and he would tell you what to do, what course to fly. So many degrees east, such and such a height, don't forget to check your millibars when you're landing, it's on, wherever you're going to be. So many degrees, so many flies, so long minutes on such and such a course, and back again. Fly on a reciprocal, and fly, all sorts of compass points you had to fly on, which he would tell you, because you had an earphone in, you see. We didn't have any radios in the aircraft in those days. A thing I forgot to mention. And if you saw the balloons going up at Derby, the first thing to do was to race back. Because you had no other way of letting you know. You had to keep your eyes open. Back to the link now. And the last thing on the course and the link you did was what they call fly a Maltese cross. Now you can imagine what that is like. A Maltese cross has got a hell of a lot of turnings. And every now and then he would say, come and check your millibars. That is, in other words, the pressure, because that affects your altimeter. And at the end of that, it takes about, it took best part of an hour to do the Maltese cross. And you're stuffed in this little tiny simulator link. The end of the hour, he comes and releases it, and you get out. And incidentally, you always had to wear slippers there because the floor was highly polished. Always very highly polished. When I'd finished, I went, I said, well, how about that, Sergeant? What was that like? Well, it wasn't too bad. He said, there's only one thing wrong with that. I said, what's that? He said, you're 200 feet underground. I always remember that. I must have forgotten to check my millibars at some point. After our course at our flying course on Magisters, we were then sent on 7 days leave. We also always got plenty of leave with the glider pilot regiment. And then we had to report back to TAME, which is now called Haddenham. And here we were introduced to the Hotspur glider. Now, never having flown a glider before, it was quite an encouraging and frightening trip, because we had to remember that we couldn't go round again. We hadn't got an engine to take us round again if we missed our landing spot. And we then did a lot of intensive Hotspur flying. That is the small glider, the 8-seater. I'm checking in my book. We did all sorts of things. Corporal Lewis, that's right. Charlie, I think we did a number of hours on our motorless, as we call them then. Four.
Were they easy to handle, these hot
spots? Well, very easy to handle. Very easy. But the frightening part was that this was the first time we hadn't got an engine. That was the point. However, once we got used to them, we could really handle them very well. And we could fly them, I should think, reasonably accurately, basically. We could. We did some 4, 8, 12, 20. In the finish, we used to do what they call dive approaches. And that was, you would take the angle of the aircraft, you would release from the aircraft, and instead of carrying on the direction that the aircraft was going, you would dive to the ground and do a steep turn on the ground and land basically in a different direction. So that the enemy, the idea was that you would build up a good ground speed, you could hedge hop to your landing spot, having spotted it from the air. It was a bit dicey to do, but it was very interesting. Only the Hotspur, unfortunately, developed a fault, which was the tailplane came off occasionally when we were pulling out of the dive, and quite a few were killed doing that. So they decided to strut the tailplane and stop the dive approach.
Was that necessarily fatal if the tailplane fell off?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, you were all killed. They were killed. Tailplane falls off, you've no control, straight into the deck.
Did you ever see any fatal accidents?
I knew. No, I didn't actually see one. But one did happen whilst we were there. And we were all a bit nervous about doing the dive approach after that. In fact, it was stopped.
So it was the dive approach which tended to make the tailplane come off?
Yes.
How big were these gliders?
The Hotspur.
Were they meant to carry troops?
Yeah, eight. Only eight troops. They weren't very big. Eight fully armed troops.
Was that the only glider you had practice on at TAME?
At TAME, that was the only one. Ah, yes, whilst we were there, was it there? Yes, the King and Queen came to have a look at a demonstration. That's right, an exercise absolute, yes.
And after TAME? What happened after TAME?
Ah, then after TAME we had another leave. Told you we got lots of leave, another 7 days. And we went to Bryce Norton.
That was nearby, was it?
No, Bryce Norton's Oxfordshire.
Where's TAME then? Isn't that in the same area?
TAME's... Yes, but TAME is... Oh, I don't know, about 80 miles away, I think. Well, yeah, I suppose so. I can't remember.
What happened at Bryce Norton?
Well, Bryce Norton, we were then introduced to the Hawser.
Was that much different from the Hotspur?
Oh, yes, much bigger. It had an 88-foot wingspan. Much bigger, and that carried 28 troops. Or a jeep, and 6-pounder, or... Oh, what else? We used to carry a lot of heavy, quite a few tons of equipment in there. Quite much bigger.
How did that handle in comparison?
Very well. Well, reasonably well. It was a bit heavy on tow, depending what equipment you've got in it. But a different approach altogether, having a 80-degree flap, you went straight down to the ground, and then you had an area of sink about 200 feet off the ground where you'd check and float it down onto the ground. It was a bit different in the landing procedure.
What kind of planes towed the gliders?
Well, the Hotspur was towed by a Hector Hart, strange as it may seem. But the Hawser, of course, was towed by Stirlings or Halifax at one time, or Dakotas.
Were you nervous about the towing procedure?
No. The RAF were brilliant pilots, all of them. Pity we never went in the RAF, I often think. However, our military training came in very useful when we really went into action.
You were in a separate regiment called the Glider Pilot Regiment.
Yeah, that's right. Now, whilst we were doing our Hawser training, our colonel, who I only ever met once, Colonel Rock, ex-RE, a very nice man, was killed on night flying. And we had a new colonel, and that was Major Chatterton, who I'd first met. I mentioned him very early on. He became the colonel of the regiment. He was very good, really, George, but he didn't really do what he said he would do. We were all going to get our commissions, and we didn't. But I believe that was the War Office, not him.
What did you think you were preparing for, specifically?
Land behind the enemy lines. We knew that. Quite obvious.
But did you think that there was some particular area?
We didn't know where. At that time, not in the... When I finished my Hawser flying... There we are. Because we used to do night flying as well, and that was always a bit dicey. We used to land on flares, five gooseneck flares, which were paraffin flares. And you only had five, and that was, if you're doing 5,000-foot release, it's a bit dicey to sort of pick out five tiny little flares at 5,000 feet. But we had very few accidents on it, very few. You had to remember where you were, really, on your instruments as well. We did quite a lot of Hawser flying in between leaves, and we did a big demonstration for, again, the King and Queen in, I think it was the February, I think it was, 43. Yeah, let's see if try and get it here. Let's have a look.
So you were quite a few months at Bryce Martin.
Right, where did I leave Bryce? I left in the October, Bryce Norton. Then we went down to Bulford. And then we went, we were sort of doing anything we could here. We were ferrying horses. And where did we ferry them to? Various places like Andover and Herne, where we joined 296 Squadron. That's the RAF squadron. With Albemarle's. And we were flying behind those. And we flew from Andover down to Herne. It's not very far. But we took the whole of the squadron. I had an engine from an Albemarle strapped in the back of my horse. I remember that. We took the full squadron complete with all the spares down to Herne. And then at Herne, we went into Crawford's Cafe as a billet. Our little flight was quite good.
Were you by now getting impatient to be in operations, or were you content?
No, we were enjoying ourselves with the flying. And we couldn't see where any operations could possibly be at that time. Because we had really, if you think about that time of the war, 42,